So one of the things that I did near the end of the last lecture was we finally got this RGT relating r's to r primes. And then we also, near the end, took the derivative with respect to this length scale b, or this scaling, and we got this result. And one of the things we noted is that we knew we had a fixed point at 0, 0, and that was the Gaussian fixed point. And one of the questions is, are there others? And we've been doing a lot of math, as you know, just to get here, but today we're really going to be able to think about physics again. Before getting further, I did want to note a couple of things. One thing I compared to Francois's notes, and I think those were in chapter 9. And I showed an agreement between when we calculate the derivative with respect to b and the values that he got there for the phi-4 theory in Euclidean action. And one question that I got was there was this S d g or decoupling with respect to S, where S was related to this B that we use in this way. So it was just a transformation. But importantly, this was equal to, in his notes, the minus beta function. And so I had a question of, why is this thing with respect to the length scale, why is this the minus of the beta function? And the key is that in QFT and in a lot of places, the beta function is defined using the energy. And so, and so you saw that if you look at, I think it's chapter 8, he defines the beta function using derivative of the energy scale. And so just as we, and so these are inversely related. So if we're talking about long distances, we're talking about the shorter ener the lower energies. And so because of that, this is equal to the negative of this derivative. And so sometimes in statistical field theory, you will see a beta function that's related to the length scale. And these derivatives are the ones that we are interested in. Francois just told me he actually refers to that as the Wilson function to avoid any confusion. So this could also be called Wilson function. But hopefully that clears up some of the questions about sines and beta function versus what we're looking at with renormalization group transformation. But they both have the same information in them, just in a different way. And another slight correction, I believe it was on Monday, we had all of these sums that involve k mu, these k mu components, each one of them being less than the cutoff. I was in discrete space here, and if you think about a lattice, it's like going from, say, one cubic lattice to another cubic lattice. So really, this is a question of each component being less than the cutoff. So if you're thinking about it in 3D, it's sort of a question of, are you inside of this cube versus outside? And I was thinking in terms of a sphere, which you probably saw, in other contexts for continuous space, the renormalization group, you think of it as being within a sphere. So I use sphere a lot of times, but really it's sort of being inside a cube or a square versus outside of it, because it's each one of these components. If one is too big, then you're outside of this. It doesn't really make a difference for the calculations at all, but the mental model there was off. one of the things we did at the end of yesterday is we took these derivatives, and actually I will lower this again quickly, because when we are finding the fixed points, basically the question is, where are these derivatives both equal to zero? And you're going to do some of the things that I'm doing now for the fixed point in class, in tutorial, at a different time. But we already knew that 0, 0 was sort of trivially true. Now let's just assume that that we're not looking for 0, 0. So we want a solution where u star is not equal to zero. And so the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the second equation. And that one was epsilon u minus 3 u squared over 2 plus some constant, some other numbers, is equal to 0. I'm going to assume that the fixed point does not include u star equal to 0. So I'm going to go ahead and divide through by a u. And so when I do that, I get epsilon. And by the way, this epsilon comes from the assumption we're going to be looking close to four dimensions, but we're going to be looking a little bit under four dimensions. So actually, when Wilson originally wrote a paper about this, he called it physics in 3.999 dimensions. So we're going to assume a small epsilon right now. So d is close to four, but it's not quite four, and it's a little bit less than four. So we have 3 u over 2, we have this kd, r plus the cutoff squared squared is equal to 0. So you know, here's where we are making an assumption that u star is not equal to 0. And then we can solve this for u, of course, and get u in terms of r. And you know, what I'm doing here is just a very straightforward solving two equations with two unknowns. So I did, I solved this one for u, but it's in terms of r. So now I can substitute it into the first equation. Going to have 2r, and then when I put this in for u, the 2s will cancel. I will get an epsilon over 3, and then I have r plus the cutoff squared squared, so one of those will cancel, and then this kd number cancels too. Okay, and then when I solve this for r, I get minus epsilon cutoff squared over 3. Because that's just factoring out the r's, so I should get a, and then I get a 2 plus epsilon over 3. And then we're going to do an approximation. So again, we in this case, we are interested in only up to order epsilon. And so when you do this, You find you can just, even if you do this and you expand this out, you're just going to get 1/2 times 1 plus something else in epsilon, but you have an epsilon up here, so that would lead to squares. So you're just going to have a 2 times 3, so we're going to get minus epsilon cut off squared over 6. So that's our R value. And then now we can find U, because of course we have R that's no longer in terms of U. And so we can just put this directly into our equation over here. So we get U is equal to 2/3 epsilon, and then we have minus the cutoff squared over 6 plus gamma squared squared. Divided by KD. And then now we actually need to work with KD in order to expand out to order epsilon. So there's a little bit more we have to do with the U value. So KD, remember this KD constant was related to the solid angle for d minus 1 dimensions times the cutoff of to the d over 2 pi to the d. So this should be in your notes from yesterday. And then we do have an expression for this s d minus 1. You know, it's a basic mathematics expression that's been derived. I'm not going to show it here, but you can look it up, for example, in Pothria, Appendix C. And it's related to this d minus 1 dimensional sphere. And so the point is, when we have an expression like this, and it involves this gamma function and these other things to the d power, we can define them for non-integer d values, which is good, because that's what we were thinking about. We were thinking about some non-integer value of d that was very close to 4. So we can define for non-integer d. And so we could basically write, you know, we're interested in k of 4 minus epsilon, because that's the dimension we want. And then these things we can write as 2 pi to the 2 minus epsilon over 2 gamma to the 4 minus epsilon over 2 pi to a 4 minus epsilon, then the gamma function of 2 minus epsilon over 2. And then we want to think about approximating this gamma in some way, because this is the function where we have some number plus something small. So presumably that's the thing that we could write in terms of, you know, something plus something order of epsilon. And indeed, if you look at gamma of 2 minus epsilon over 2, you could write this as 1 minus epsilon over 2 plus 1. And I wrote it in that order because then it allows you to use an identity you may have seen for the gamma function, which is 1 minus epsilon over 2 times the gamma function of 1 minus epsilon over 2. And the thing with this is I'm just going to say this is 1 to 0th order if you make epsilon small enough. And I haven't truly shown you that it's really just 1 plus something to epsilon. Maybe there's something to order epsilon squared and so on. But I guess the point is it's something that's 1 plus epsilon to something higher. And so gamma of 1 is actually equal to gamma of 2. So we can then say that gamma of 4 minus epsilon is equal to 2 pi to the minus epsilon over 2, the cutoff to 4 minus epsilon over our 2 pi to the 4 minus epsilon. And then we have something that is the gamma function of 2, because like I said, we can write it as 2 again because it's just gamma of 1 is equal to gamma of 2, plus something of order epsilon. And so then we can approximate this simply as k for 4 dimensions plus something of order epsilon. So then we can get our value for u. U is approximately, going back to what we had, 2/3 epsilon, and then we have minus epsilon cutoff over 6 plus cutoff squared divided by k4 plus something of order epsilon, which then allows us to simply write this as we have an epsilon out here, so we're not going to care about any of these higher orders of epsilon. And so we're really just going to get 2/3 this cutoff to the 4 over k4 epsilon. So we have another fixed point at R star U star, which I'll use just to denote the fixed point, minus epsilon over 6 cutoff squared. 2/3 gamma to the 4 k4 epsilon. And so this is the case when we are close to d equals 4, and this is known as the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Now, what happens to this fixed point once epsilon gets small enough? I mean, as epsilon goes to 0, basically.
It goes to the trivial fixed point.
That's right. So this fixed point merges with the Gaussian fixed point. D equals 4. And now with this information, I'm going to start plotting and drawing a picture of what's happening physically with the system. And as we learn more, we'll add more to the plot. But in the past, I had these RG flow diagrams, and they were just in one dimension. Now we have both an R and a U. Those are our two parameters. So we're going to show the plot using both R and U. For the Gaussian fixed point, it was just at 0, 0. So I'm going to just mark this point by G. Wilson-Fisher fixed point is at minus R and plus U. So I'm just going to mark it over here as Wilson-Fisher. And what we want to do, and I'll just say that this is D is less than 4, epsilon greater than 0. But now that we have these points, we want to really be able to get the flow lines, because that'll give us a picture of what's going on here. And as you'll see, when we get flow lines, we'll get them by linearizing close to a fixed point. We will also learn something about the critical exponents. One other thing, remember that R is proportional to T. And this was the reduced temperature from mean field theory. So that doesn't mean that it's going to be the reduced temperature for this new fixed point, but it is the reduced temperature for the Gaussian fixed point. And the key thing to keep in mind then is that this R constant is going to be related to the temperature. So we really do have a direct physical way to think about R. One other thing that I want to say, and that's about U. So I've had some questions about U in the past, and there is an important thing to keep in mind about U. If we think about the 5-4 theory in real space, we can remind ourselves again that it was the derivative with respect to phi squared plus some r times phi squared plus some u times phi to the 4. And I'm just using these couplings generally to get an idea of what it looks like. With mean field theory, what we would do is set derivatives to 0. And so in mean field theory, what we would do is minimize r phi squared plus u phi to the 4. And this is very reminiscent of what we were doing in Landau theory and looking at where we would find minima of the functions. And so, does anyone remember, if we were building a Landau theory and we have something to the fourth power, in order for the Landau theory to make sense, what does the sign of u need to be?
Positive.
Positive. And why is that?
To be bounded below.
Exactly. Yeah, otherwise the minima don't make sense. We just go forever. We want things that look like that or like that, etc. So this tells us that if u were less than 0, that is unphysical. In the case of our thing, we've truncated it at phi to the 4. So if we got an unphysical u, maybe that we just need to go further. Now, I've mentioned, though I did not show, that if you include the higher order terms, though, it still doesn't change the answer. So ultimately, we can keep in mind that this side of the plot for minus u is going to be unphysical. Now, what I said I wanted to do next was figure out what the flow lines would look like. And so now we're going to use some of the techniques I talked about on Monday of linearizing and finding information from that. Let's linearize the flow equations. Near the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And so for that, remember we wanted these fluctuations, du, dr, and sorry, yeah, dr, or delta r and delta u, and those are equal to whatever the value is minus the fixed point. We're getting fluctuations from compared to the fixed point. And then the same goes for delta r prime, delta u prime, and these are both fluctuations. And remember, we wanted to get something that was like delta k prime equaling m times delta k. Okay, so if I think about, and I'm going to keep thinking about this in the derivative form, if I'm thinking about for this, for the fluctuations, this is r prime minus r star, u prime minus u star, but those are constant, and so we're really just asking. We're really just linearizing the derivative of r prime u prime. And so that's just showing that this derivative is really the same. Yeah. Okay, so now let's do the pieces. And maybe I'll just show these over here. So ddb for the fluctuations in r prime. So they're equal to, first of all, the function at the fixed point. So here, remember, I'm going to make use of the equation for r prime. So that's that 2r plus u over 2 kd. So 2r squared, sorry, 2 times r star plus u over 2 times kd over r star plus this squared. And of course, this piece is equal to 0 anyway, because this is just our fixed point itself. But now we need the pieces. And so that's really our delta k prime. But now we need the pieces related to the matrix. And so for this first part, does anyone remember how to get the matrix elements that we would need for this kind of thing? Or it was like delta k prime with respect to or the derivative of k prime with respect to k, but then for the components that we would need. So what we're going to do is do the derivative with respect to r of this thing. Evaluated at u star r star times the fluctuations in R. plus the derivative with respect to u of 2r plus u over 2 kd over r plus the cutoff squared evaluated at r star u star times the fluctuations in u. And so when you do this, we're just going to take the derivatives. So we're going to get 2 minus u star over 2 kd over r plus delta squared delta r plus derivative with respect to u of this. I'm just going to get u no I don't I shouldn't have a u there I'm just going to get 1/2 kd r over cutoff squared and then the fluctuations in u. And then we have our u star value. This should be an r star value. And when we put in these values for u star and r star, we should just get, and then we approximate to first order in epsilon, we get 2 minus epsilon of 3 delta r plus 1/2 k4 over the cutoff squared, 1 minus epsilon over 6, and times the fluctuations in u. Any questions on this right now? Okay, well, we can do something similar now for the delta u prime. So when we do that, we are gonna get that first piece, which was just equal to 0, but we're going to use the second equation, of course, now, the u equation. So this piece is equal to 0. And then what are we going to do for the next pieces here?
We do the same. We take the partial with respect to r.
Yeah, we take the derivative with respect to r, and we take the derivative with respect to u of that expression up there. Let me go ahead and box this one in. Okay. partial derivative with respect to R. And then we need to evaluate this at R star U star, and we multiply by the fluctuations in R plus the derivative with respect to U minus 3U squared over 2 KD R plus cutoff squared squared R star U star times the fluctuations in U. And so then the thing with this one is I take the derivative with respect to R. This term is going to go away. I'm going to get minus 2 up here, and then I have to the minus 3. So I should get, so the minus sign will go away. So I get 3 U star squared KD over R star plus cutoff squared to the third power times the fluctuations in R. And then the second one with respect to U, I should get an epsilon and I should get a 6 U over 2 or a 3 U. So I'm going to get epsilon minus 3 U star KD over R star plus the cutoff squared squared times delta U. And so when I look at this, I have a 3u star squared. But if I remind myself what u star is, it's epsilon. And so I have something that's multiplied by an epsilon squared already. And so I'm not going to care about epsilon squared or higher. So I'm just going to say this is something of order epsilon squared times the fluctuations in R. Now this one I am going to write out because this one also ends up being in order epsilon. And so this one, we're going to get epsilon minus 2 times the cutoff to the 4 epsilon 1 over, and we put in R star, we're going to get minus epsilon over 6 plus 1 squared times the cutoff squared times the fluctuations in U. And when I do this, the cutoffs are going to cancel, and then I'm going to have something that is 1 minus something with higher epsilons. So all I'm going to have left for this term is just a 2 times epsilon here. So I'm going to have epsilon minus 2 epsilon. And so for the second piece, I'm going to get order epsilon squared times the fluctuations in R minus epsilon times the fluctuations in U. And so if we think about, well, I'll write it down in matrix form next, but if we think about it physically, what we're saying is when we're close to the critical point, but we fluctuate U and R a bit away from the critical point, how do the fluctuations in U prime and U and R prime change when we scale with this B? Thank you. So as a matrix, we see that ddb of r prime and u prime is equal to just these values that I found up here. I have 2 minus epsilon over 3. Then I have 1/2 k4 cutoff squared 1 minus epsilon over 6. You know, and these are what we're multiplying delta r, delta u fluctuations. What are the bottom 2 entries of this then? Thinking about this in the matrix form. Yes, exactly. We're going to take this, but yes, we just call it 0. And then we're going to take the minus epsilon here. And so this is a triangular matrix, which is nice for us because it means we automatically can grab the eigenvalues from it. So eigenvalues, we get lambda 1 equals 2 minus epsilon over 3. And I'm going to actually leave some space for a reason I'll make clear in a bit. Lambda 2 is equal to minus epsilon. And let's think, now that we know about eigenvalues, on Monday we talked about whether they corresponded to relevant or irrelevant couplings. So in the case where epsilon is greater than 0, which was what we were originally thinking about when we're just below 4 dimensions, what is lambda 1 versus lambda 2? Well, what is the sign of lambda 1 for small epsilon that's positive? Or epsilon greater than 0, but, you know, epsilon very small, lambda 1 is what? It's positive, right? And what does that mean for lambda 1? If it's because lambda 1 is positive, that means lambda 1 will correspond to a relevant direction. Because remember, greater than 0 was relevant. So then, what about lambda 2 here? I mean, just going off of, you know.
It's negative, so it's irrelevant.
Yes, so we'll correspond to irrelevant. Well, we call them scaling fields, and we'll get to scaling fields in a bit. And so these are the eigenvalues. If we want to figure out what these directions that they correspond to are, we need to find the eigenvectors. Now, I'm not going to show this, you know, you do standard linear algebra, but when you do that, what you're going to get is you're going to get V1, which corresponded to lambda 1, which was relevant. V1 is just 1, 0. And so this is important. This is actually then in the R direction, because we had RU. So I'm going to call this now VR. And this is the thing that's the direction that was corresponding to the temperature. And then V2 it's going to be minus K over 4 divided by 4 times the cutoff squared as well as 1. And so this one includes a piece in U and in R. So I'm just going to call this VU tilde. I'm going to define a U tilde direction on the plot when we think about this. And so I'm going to go ahead and do this for the eigenvalues as well. I'm going to call this lambda R, and I'm going to call this lambda U tilde. Before we go back to the plot, I wanted to think a little bit about what is the new critical temperature, because we know it shouldn't be the same as the mean field theory one. So what is the critical temperature for this? So what is TC for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point? And I'm just going to call this T star, because we've been using the TC symbol for the mean field theory one, and then that's what we put into our model when we were defining our couplings. Well, remember, R was equal to this reduced temperature for the mean field theory times beta C for the mean field theory times J A squared. And you can put in the mean field theory values, and you'll just get T minus this lambda plus 2JD over J A squared. But then R star for Wilson-Fisher, well, we found it, and I've written it up there, R star U star. Now we have a minus epsilon over 6 times the cutoff squared over 6. So that means that we could write that R star is equal to T star minus lambda plus 2JD over JA squared. But that is equal to minus epsilon cutoff over 6. And so then if you solve it for this new T star, what you get is the mean field theory result, but you subtract an additional thing that is dependent on epsilon. So what you find is that this T star is less than the TC that the mean field theory would have predicted. And does that make sense? Yeah, can anyone explain to me why? Because what we're doing here is we're taking more fluctuations into account, right? That's because we have wrote it as a field theory. So we're not just doing average field, we have more fluctuations. So if we have more fluctuations, how would we expect that to affect the temperature where you see the transition to an ordered state?
Increase,
no, actually, because if the temperature increased where you got an ordered state, that meant you wouldn't have to go far, go as low to fight off the fluctuations and get order. In fact, TC is going to end up being lower than what you would get for mean field theory. Basically, mean field theory is more optimistic about where you could get an ordered state. But once you have additional fluctuations, you have to force the temperature down lower before you can get to an ordered state. So another way to put this, fluctuations make ordering more difficult. And that's really what this is telling us. When we include the fluctuations, ordering is harder, so we have to lower the temperature at which the ordering happens is lower than what we would have thought from mean field theory. Okay, so now we're ready to return to our picture. And we're going to make use of our eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And what they tell, and they're going to tell us something about each of these directions. So this one is about fluctuations in the r direction. So you know that's our vr. And then this U tilde is about fluctuations in the U tilde direction. So that's going to be going this way, like some. And it's not really, this is all very local. I'm going to end up filling in some things that you can't tell from our linearization here, but it will tell us about what's going on near the critical point of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. Okay, and so then we have to remember, we have lambda r is equal to 2 minus epsilon over 3, lambda u bar, or u tilde, that is equal to minus epsilon. And we can think about using basically our directions, and I'm just going to keep this as r. We can say that dr db is equal to lambda r times r. But that, and because this is just our vector here, it's diagonal. But that tells us then that you can say that r is equal to r naught e to the lambda r t. And remember this t, this lambda r was greater than zero. It's relevant. And so what this differential equation tells us is that if we're a little bit over here, if we're positive, we're going to get more positive. And if we're negative, we're going to get more negative. And so we have a repulsive fixed point, at least in this direction. And we could say the same for u. U is going to end up, u tilde is going to be u tilde times u tilde initial times e to the minus lambda u tilde and I called this a t. Lambda u tilde times u tilde. And so, but this one, and I just put in a minus sign already. But this one is going to be negative. And so what this one is going to tell us is that in this direction, it's attractive. We are going to go to the fixed point. And so that's what this irrelevant means in this case. And so this just came from lambda r greater than 0, and then lambda u tilde less than 0. And when we look at these things, basically we will get, if we have a stable fixed point, what we're calling a stable fixed point, what we need for that is we do always have one unstable direction. So always unstable in the t direction for finite temperature phase transitions. Or if we're talking about quantum phase transitions, which we'll talk about next week, or for quantum, phase transitions, one coupling. And that one coupling is going to be where we see the phase transition. And then considered stable if it is attractive in the other parameters. Because what we would find is we could start at some other combination of couplings. And as we increased our scale, we would flow to the fixed point here. And really, all along this line, we have phase transitions in temperature. In fact, if I fill it out, using other directions, basically, the flow lines look something like this. If you move a little bit off the line, you're going to flow in these two directions. And by the way, this is high temperature, so this is the paramagnetic phase over here that you'd be flowing to, and this side is the ferromagnetic phase. This is where everything would be aligned.
Emily, mm-hmm. What was the slanted lines to connect?
This is showing other flow lines, because you could have any combination of these U and R couplings. So if you are at some U and R, and then you do the renormalization group procedure, what are your new U and R prime? Where are you going? And so that's what this is showing you. That's what this diagram shows. Now, you're going to do some things, I think, on Monday to look at the case when epsilon is less than 0 or d is less than 4. But the point is, in that case, let's think about where the Wilson-Fisher fixed point would end up. Okay, I have it way up there. But if we have a negative epsilon, then where does this one end up? Which quadrant would you see it in?
Mm-hmm. It'll be in the unphysical region.
That's right. So in this case, Wilson-Fisher is unphysical. So when we are looking at the phase transition for higher dimensions, greater than 4, we don't have a Wilson-Fisher fixed point here. We do have the Gaussian fixed point, and the thing is, if you look at the Gaussian fixed point there, we're going to get, and I didn't show you all those lambdas. That's something you would work out for the Gaussian fixed point. I haven't worked it out today, but what you would find is now there's like some U tilde direction that is attractive to the Gaussian fixed point. And then, of course, and we still get the repulsion here. And so the point is that at D, I said this wrong. At D greater than 4, the Gaussian fixed point is actually the one that is describing our phase transition. And the mean field theory is actually telling us, as we know, about the Gaussian fixed point. And so renormalization group theory was really what allowed people to sort out what was going on. And it also helped with this idea of universality, of figuring out why so many models can lead to the same results, because we have this idea of a flow and things can flow to fixed points. Okay, right before the break, I want to show one more thing. Maybe I'll just show it on one of these, this board in the back. So you can use these things. If you remember, we had these relations that involved scaling fields. And I didn't have time to derive everything on Monday, but you can look in your notes to get the details. A quick thing to note is we had that TR prime was equal to b to the lambda r TR for these fields. And this, the one, the TR, the scaling field that corresponded to the lambda r, you know, this was the reduced temperature. We could interpret it that way. And so then one can get that the correlation length goes as TR to the minus 1 over lambda r. And so we can get that because we know which direction is our relevant direction. And our relevant direction was this lambda r. So nu is equal to 1 over 2 minus epsilon over 3, which to first order in epsilon is 1 half plus epsilon over 12. And this value was what we got with mean field theory. And then this is a correction. And then the others, which I think you will get some of these others in the tutorial. You can get that alpha is epsilon over 6. Beta is 1 half plus epsilon over 6. Gamma is 1 plus epsilon over 6 delta is 3 plus epsilon, and eta is equal to 0. That one's still the same as in mean field theory. But you can do something that's kind of crazy, because we did all this stuff predicated on the idea that epsilon was very small. So we could take things to first order in epsilon. But what if we just used epsilon equals 1? Because that would allow us to get d equals 3, of course. And the kind of crazy thing is that if you look at the critical exponents and you compare them to numerical values for d equals 3, we have 0.11 versus 0.17, 0.33 versus also 0.33, 1.24 versus 1.17, 4.79 versus 4, 0.04 versus 0, and 0.62 versus 0.58. And the results are even better when you get to, as you go to additional orders in epsilon. And we still don't really know why this works so well. This is something that you'll discuss in the tutorial some too. Why does it make sense? But people use these methods still. I mean, for one thing, renormalization group, we really do get a qualitative picture of what's going on. And then it turns out we can get quantitative results, at least better results than what we would see for mean field theory. Let's go ahead and take a 5-minute break and then continue. Go ahead.
So is the Gaussian fixed point in D less than 4 unstable, or?
Yes, it's unstable.
In like all directions, or is it like?
I believe it's unstable in, yes, all the directions end up being relevant.
So the straight line between Wilson-Fisher point and Gaussian point there, is the line the direction of the second eigenvector? Yes.
Yes, this is the U tilde type of line. Now really U tilde, we've only shown it in the vicinity here, but if you were to get all of this, you know, and really use probably numerics, use a differential equation sort of software, you could get these flow lines, and you could see that you flow from Gaussian fixed point to here.
Okay.
These diagram that you showed, where are the phase transition happening? You said about 1 in the...
Yeah, there's a phase transition here. And I'm saying that this is really a critical line, but you wouldn't find out about universality here. But as you scale, you move over to here along this line. And this is where you get the critical exponents for the transition, because you're not at a fixed point here, basically.
So it's somehow like a miracle that this thing works when we take so on, right? Like,
right.
It seems like some sort of like mathematical coincidence rather than.
I know it does. The thing is, it works in other systems too, but we don't really have a guarantee that it's going to work. That's the thing. So for my PhD thesis, one of the main parts was calculating critical exponents numerically to a good accuracy for a fermionic model. And one of the things we found is we've managed to get a great agreement between both these epsilon expansion types of methods and the numerics. And that's fermions, and it's more, I mean, maybe less trivial than a spin model, I don't know. But yeah. And there are other epsilon expansions people do too. They also go up from two dimensions using a different type of expansion there, and they can compare results from different directions too. Okay, so that's really going to conclude the lectures on the renormalization group. And I wanted to briefly talk about a model that is not the Ising model before moving on. And it will also be a callback to the Landau-Ginzburg theory. So this is going to be models with continuous symmetries. And so before, we had the Ising model, right? And that was a lattice of spins that were either up or down. There were two states they could be in. And then we wrote the energy for those as minus j times the sum over nearest neighbors, sigma I, sigma j. And so with this model, we had a discrete Z2 symmetry. And that's just, we could take all the sigma i's to minus sigma i's, and we would get the same model. What I'm going to introduce now is the vector model. And for this model, the spins are now, we're going to have two sets of dimensions. For one, we have the dimension of our lattice, which is going to be d still. But then each of these spins is just going to be a vector. And this is a classical vector, and it just can point in various directions. So these are our degrees of freedom. And the energy for the vector model, you could write as, okay, well, I guess I wrote this as 1/2 ij, jij, I wrote it in this form, but that's fine. And then I have an si vector dot sj vector, where si, as I mentioned, is a vector. And so you would say, you know, it's got n components, si1, si2, up to sin. So we have d dimensions, and we have n vectors that live in the d dimensions. And then we also have that the vectors have magnitudes of one. And the point is, for this is going to be, well, how do we minimize the energy for this vector model? Just sort of comparing to what we were doing for the spins.
Are they all pointing in the same direction?
Yeah. All the vectors need to point in the same direction. But the thing is, we have much more freedom now, because the vectors could, we could pick any of the directions. We have a big rotational symmetry here, because any of those directions, as long as the vectors are all pointing in the same direction, that will minimize the energy. So continuous ON symmetry is what we say for all the rotational directions. And energy is minimized when the spins are aligned. And it turns out that this continuous symmetry and this real sort of degeneracy that we can have in the lowest energy will make a difference, will make some difference in the behavior for the vector model. Now, in your notes with this model, there are some notes that go through the steps to actually get the field theory for the model, and it works very similarly to the Ising model. But the other way we could go about this, and that you'll see in many papers, is based on the symmetries, we can jump to the result and be like Landau, and we can give a Landau-Ginzburg theory. So that's what I'm going to do in this short time. So we can define an action. I'm going to define this action in real space. And since it's a field theory, Euclidean field theory, I'm going to jump to continuous space as well. And we can write this as the gradient of the spin. This is a vector, so I'm going to dot it again with the gradient of the spin, plus r over 2 with this field vector dotted with itself, plus some u over 4 of the field vector dotted with itself squared. And so the point is, we've maintained the ON symmetry when we wrote this, and we also wrote it from using, these are vector fields that have scalar values, just as we started with the spins that were vector values. So it seems pretty logical that it would look something like this. And so, interestingly, at d equals 4, the behavior is qualitatively similar. To the Ising model. So as we get to higher dimensions, these things will look similar to each other, but here we'll focus on d equals 2. And so what we're going to do is we are going to write these scalar fields in terms of some new variables. So we'll write this scalar field of x. And so this is just representing one of the spins, one of the scalar fields that corresponds to a spin vector. And we're going to write it as just the magnitude times the direction of that vector. So, this is a unit vector. When we do this, the action in terms of rho and n, we can write in this way as 1/2, and then we have the gradient of rho squared. This is just a number, so we're just going to square it, the rho. So let me remind us, this is just a number, whereas the n is a vector. Then we're going to get plus 1/2 rho squared times gradient of n alpha gradient of n alpha plus r over 2 rho squared. These things just become plus u over 4 r to the 4. And this is just writing it in such a way, we're thinking about these states where the spins, yeah, are aligned. Okay, and so then let's think about the mean field theory in this context. When we use mean field theory, remember the idea is that the derivatives are zero. Of the fields are zero because we have no fluctuations. And so then we are going to minimize this piece right here. And so if we were to minimize that, you know, we would get a rho naught. And this is very much like Landau theory. It's dependent on how large, or it's dependent on the sign of R, the types of whether we get minima or not. And so this is equal to either the square root of minus r over u when r is less than 0, or it's equal to 0 when r is greater than 0. And so this is the minimum. This, of course, corresponds to a shape like that. And this corresponds to a shape like this. And this is where we have ordering, you know. At some critical temperature, we're going to have some ordering of the vector model. And what we want to do is we want to compare the type of minimum function that we get for the Ising model versus the vector model. So in the Ising model case, if we were to plot f of rho with respect to phi, we would get two types of minima here. We would have minus phi naught and plus phi naught. And you know, these just correspond to all the spins up and all the spins down. And so we get spontaneous symmetry breaking if we didn't have a magnetic field. We'd have to choose one. And the point is we have a barrier between the two minima. It takes work to be able to go from this minimum to that minimum, and so on, because that would really consist of having to flip every single spin to the other direction. These are like, this is not a very favored thing to do. On the other hand, for the vector model, if we think, and remember, we're thinking for d equals 2, well, no, we're thinking about n equals 2, not really saying. I guess we were thinking about d equals 2 as well, yeah. D equals 2, n equals 2. Then for our phi, we're going to have phi 2, phi 1, and then this is pretty tricky for me to draw. You know, if you want a good image of what this looks like, check the Mexican hat potential online. Or maybe something like... So the point is, everything is going to go, I don't know if you can even tell what I'm trying to draw. Trying to take this and rotate it, right? So you could see the perspective. And so, So what I would want to do if I was doing this well is I want all the troughs to show up in this circle that I've drawn here. Oh, that's why it looks so bad. I didn't put the troughs in the circle. Okay. I got the maxima in the correct places, but not the minima. So the point is, if you go around this circle, this is a circle of minima. And it's actually very cheap to move around the circle to the different minima. You no longer have this big barrier in the center keeping you from getting from one minima to another. You can basically tunnel through the minima all the way around. And so this is the minima are connected. By the continuous symmetry. And then you could actually compare different types of fluctuations. So if you think, you could think about a fluctuation that goes along the minima, and you could call this a delta phi perpendicular, and you could think about a minima that goes in more of the Ising direction, you know, like you're trying to get across the barrier to another minima, and this would be a delta phi one. And basically what you'll find when you look at this, if you look at this in terms of fluctuations in phi, what you will get is in terms of rho naught squared over two fluctuations. This is in the more Ising-like direction. And so you get the derivatives for those fluctuations, for both of those fluctuations. And then this is the easier fluctuation along the trough. But you will only get a mass term for the expensive fluctuation. This is the Ising-like fluctuation. And so then the point is that this delta phi perpendicular along the circle is massless. And these are actually called Goldstone modes, if you've heard that term before. And so we really have kind of these quasi-particle fluctuations that are massless. And it turns out that all of these fluctuations, because you could imagine with the vector model, you know, it's much easier if you had all the vectors facing one direction to all just, you know, slightly fluctuate, so they're all pointing in another direction. And so these Goldstone modes end up making it so that you actually do not get order until you're at higher than two dimensions. So you know, in the Ising model, we had a phase transition at d equals two. When we have a continuous symmetry, we do not have a phase transition at d equals 2. And so that was the main thing I wanted to get to. And I'm just going to state it. And that's basically the Merman-Wagner theorem. And it says, for systems with continuous symmetry, there is no long-range order at finite temperature for D less than or equal to 2. And this is called the lower critical dimension for a theory. So you learned earlier in this class about the upper critical dimension. And the upper critical dimension is related to when mean field theory is valid. On the other hand, the lower critical dimension is related to when you don't have a finite temperature phase transition. And thanks to this theorem, we happen to have an answer for any system that has these continuous.